to a different situation. We can always grow, we can always lift. My people, we can always rise. So I want you to say that word. Can y'all do that? Say rise.
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 Rise. Hello and welcome to the Green Radio Hour with John Bauermaster here on WKNY Radio Kingston, 1490 on your AM dial, 107.9 FM, streaming live and archived always at RadioKingston.org. It's the Sunday after the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, and I'm wondering, given that COVID-19 dominates our lives these days, how many of you were able to get outside and enjoy the day. Online, it seemed busier than ever, with some incredible content ranging from webinars to film screenings, Zoom panels to readings of nature writings. I managed to watch a beautiful biodoc of Jane Goodall on the National Geographic Channel and scrolled through a new film executive produced by Michael Moore called Planet of the Humans, which takes a somewhat scant look at just how much progress environmentalists have made in the past 50 years. If you're looking for some great content this coming week, check out EarthX.org and the EarthX Film Festival. Started in 2011, this Dallas event has become the world's largest Earth Day festival and goes on for nearly 2 weeks. This year, of course, it's all online. Films, panels, music, more films. Check it out, earthx.org. Today, I've got a pair of disparate friends on the line. First up is our neighbor in the hills of Woodstock, Bob Thurman. Worldwide authority on religion and spirituality, Asian history, world philosophy, Buddhist science, Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Bob and I have a wide-ranging conversation, brushing on a variety of subjects, from Buddhist beliefs in fierce compassion to how Buddhists can share anger, and more than a little bit about the future of the planet's environment and his obvious disdain for current politics as practiced in Washington, D.C. I'm curious how you're doing and how you're spending your days.
Oh, we're doing fine. We're doing fine. We're up here in the Woodstock area in the mountains, and we don't see anybody. Go for walks on the road, pass anybody only 5-10 feet away, and take a lot of hot steam baths and saunas because the heat kills any potential wandering corona. And so we're doing fine, you know. We're a little bit stressed out because my wife mainly manages a retreat center that is a part of the mission of Tibet House, a nonprofit in the city.
Sure.
And this retreat center dedicated to making known the view of Tibetan medicine tradition about healing and health matters. And we have a paid staff, et cetera, also Tibet House in the cities. No one can go to the cultural center there. So we're applying to the government, you know, for their grant or loan or whatever it is, so you can keep the staff salaries going, even though there's no income.
Yeah.
We hope that there'll be a little bit left over after Steve Mnuchin has given it all to a lot of big corporations and airlines and things to actually pay and give this particular type of fund.
Yeah, it's one of these paycheck protection plans.
Yes.
Exactly.
And so we've been a little bit busy doing that. And then also we started trying to figure out how to do some events online that could bring a trickle of income at least.
Yeah.
And so we're working on that too. I have a Saturday night thing teaching from the Vimalakirti Sutra, like a Buddhist thing, you know. So in the next 8 Saturday nights. And the first one was last Saturday night, and I have a few people enrolled.
And I have a lot of
writing I'm trying to finish. And also it's nice having our sons and grandchildren around and daughters and things. And that's all very, that's a kind of a nice benefit.
Yeah.
Actually, the thing that I have going in my mind was something I saw on I think, Instagram.
Yeah.
Somehow I occasionally glance at that. I don't really know how to use those things myself very well, but I occasionally look at them. And some lady had written there that she felt as if Mother Nature had sent us all to our rooms to think about what we have been doing, which I think is very good in considering the climate change crisis. Dealing with the crisis involves trying to figure out how not to do business as usual.
Well, of course, I'm curious. So, yeah, I'm curious if
I thought that was a rather brilliant thing that somebody else thought it up, but it's been in my mind the whole time.
Nice, but in some respects, you probably spent a lot of time isolating at home. I mean, you're kind of used to solitary time. Is that am I guessing?
Well, somewhat, but I've been pretty active for the last 50 years.
Yeah,
I just retired from university teaching last year. And then I went to have the Climate Reality Project training from Al Gore and his colleagues, and that was really fun.
Yeah, and during these last few weeks, have people been seeking you out for advice or on how to stay calm?
Somewhat, but I never manage. I don't present myself as a guru, and I'm not a guru, so I kind of put them on their own to sort of engage them with their own resources as much as I can. And I don't spend too much time on that. I am trying to finish a few overdue books. But I mean, overdue by half a decade, the worst one. Or, a year or two, the least bad ones. I'm trying to finish them as well.
Yeah, well, if nothing else, if we each individually get our long to-do lists done during this time of isolation, that may be a good thing.
Yes, well, I think that it's a terrible thing, of course, this plague that's going everywhere, and many people have died, and a lot of people have been quite sick, and I think all kinds of poor people all around the world who are uncounted and untested and will not likely be counted or tested by various governments. And or whatever, I think there's terrible suffering going on. So there's nothing to delight about. But on the other hand, if we keep increasing the carbon pollution and other greenhouse gases, and keep badly doing wrong kind of farming and chemical destruction of the soil and all of the terrible things that our industrialization is doing. With consumerism and militarism, we're going to have much worse than this. So it's in a way, the silver lining here may be for people who are not, completely victimized by it, but who are in doing business as usual and living with a lifestyle as usual, are causing the situation that will bring horrendous suffering throughout the third world, so-called third world, the tropical areas, the desertification of the destruction of rainforests. I mean, it's just inconceivable. A raising of sea levels, places like Bangladesh, there all their people becoming refugees. I mean,
it's hard to imagine.
Quite positive that some people who maybe have, although ironically, I think people who actually have power excuse themselves from exercising it benevolently by saying that they don't have power and therefore they're just going to do what everybody else does, and that's business as usual. And but we actually do have power. I've been really enjoying lately reading, since this all started. Even I discovered it before, but it wasn't out yet, and then the book came out. Dr. Mark Hyman, he has a new book called Food Fix, and it's connected with a website and a whole campaign, actually, to change big agriculture and big food the way that he's a doctor and a family physician, and I really honor that. As a doctor, as a public health measure, he's getting on the case of these people who are causing, I didn't really realize quite, I know it was taught in the Climate Reality Project training, but I didn't quite realize, because everyone always focuses always on the oil and gas industry, the fossil fuel industry. But the side industry, what one thinks of a side, is actually itself one of the major polluters, almost equal to fossil fuel, which is the food industry and the corrupt industrial agriculture.
Yeah, big agriculture, big ag.
Yeah, and the way they're ruining the soil and depleting it of carbon and throwing more nitrogen oxide all over it and NO2 everywhere, and really and having the soil wash away in floods because it's not plowed and then it's not enriched. It's terrible. And no. So, and there is regenerative agriculture, and that is also a huge remedy that should be major, you know, small farms, family farms, reviving them against the factory farms and everything. And it's so judicious the way Mark Hyman has, and so complete, and he's so aware of the pernicious lobbying effects and the volume of money with which we subsidize a poisoned food system, basically.
So we actually pay to have ourselves poisoned by these people.
How do you keep their products cheap? You know.
How do you keep?
It's really terrible.
Given this link between the way we've badly treated the environment and this pandemic, I mean, how do you keep anger out of your opinions?
Well, there's two kinds of anger. There's anger, which is a strong force of mind, connects actually to analytic intelligence, you know, an intelligence that is frustrated by not understanding something and wants to analyze or dissect that thing to find out how it works or what's its reality, what's its essence, what's its causation. You know, anger is actually associated with that in Buddhist psychology. And that's good anger because it's using a forceful energy to try to correct something that's going wrong and causing suffering. And a bad anger, though, which I try to keep out of it, and I think actually in the main, like the youth protesters and the Extinction Rebellion. I think mostly this is the good anger, because the bad anger, whereas I would say the bad anger are the, you know, the radical people who want to break store windows and, you know, who do vandalism and thereby bring down the wrath of the so-called conservatives on any kind of push for reform. So the is therefore bad anger is where the anger is pushing you. You become the tool of the anger. You can't control those emotional impulses, and you overdo and you cause terrible blowback and violence, and it becomes violent and so forth. And that's a bad anger. And the way you keep that and only stick to the good anger of trying to understand and trying to maintain a method to provoke understanding in people who are stuck on business as usual, the only way to do that is to realize that the bad anger will defeat your purpose, because you'll get out of control. And, you know, it's like Grasshopper, you know, famous kung fu program.
Yeah,
Grasshopper did not lose his temper, or rather he didn't give over himself to his temper when the cowboys were behaving badly as he wandered in the West with his flute and thought about his guru. And he only, you know, good martial arts, they don't get angry at the opponent, and they take the violent opposition of the opponent and turn it back on itself by staying cool themselves.
Oh, that's great.
And yet being forceful when push comes to shove.
Yeah.
So those are two kinds. And how one keeps the anger out is by realizing its ineffectiveness. I think the bad one, you know.
But
I know sometimes one does blow it, you know, one blows it, and then one always regrets what one does when one blows it, because there's always blowback. This I feel is the tremendous power of Greta Thunberg.
Greta Thunberg, yes.
That she has this sort of very fragile persona, and she doesn't hide it. You know, talks about Asperger's and her story of having a nervous breakdown as a pre-teenager and everything. And focusing on this one reality point about how we're destroying life, ourselves ultimately and others for the moment. But when she says these forceful things, which are highly critical of these people that she speaks to, these powerful people, they can't claim that she's being overbearing and that her style is somehow, you know, offensive. Because it comes from this fragile vessel, you know. And yet she's telling them, how about actually caring for your children, you know. How about, you know, following the science and being realistic, et cetera. You know, I mean, she's so great, you know. in that sense. And I think the youth rebellion that she stimulates, probably some of them will lose it because they're not training in mindfulness and they're not well educated in how to control one's emotions. We don't teach that yoga in schools, which we should. But which doesn't just mean meditation, it means being more self-aware of how the mind works. That's the answer to rather circuitous answer, anger question.
And your podcast is called what? Mother Earth in Crisis, which you developed, long before this notion of a global pandemic. Given this pandemic, how are we doing? Is this pandemic related to our bad attitude towards the environment? Is there a connection?
Well, in a way, you can see it took the pandemic to have us now for several months on the planet as a whole. We have decreased carbon emissions by 10%, I think, or more, temporarily. And people are looking around in Beijing and in Los Angeles, and there's no smog. And there's no horrible smoke of coal mines. And gee whiz, it's possible to be alive without producing that crap,
It's a heavy...
This is a very creative thing.
It's a heavy price to pay.
Tens of thousands. It's not as heavy as the price of continuing. The people in those so-called town meetings on the climate on CNN...
Right.
Who kept saying to who work for those television interviewers work for the oil industry and the fossil fuel industry and big food and big ag, because those are the people buy, and big pharma, because they're buying the time on which they're doing that. And then they keep saying to Bernie and others, well, that's a lot of money. Oh, that's so expensive. Oh, that's too much of a price. We can't do that. And then the Bernie and them are not really having ready. They didn't. Now and then they threw out a figure, but they don't really have a precise figure of the cost of continuing business as usual, the multi-trillion dollar cost that is going to come out from, for example, the health disaster that we're in. And also, I was really reading the Food Fix book. I was so excited because they never mentioned in talking about that. Never once did any of them mention, they just talked about fixing it about the insurance companies and getting better prices for the medicines from Big Pharma, as if it was just a financial thing. But they, none of them are into how big food and big agriculture are creating poisonous food that has filled 50% of the American population with chronic diseases that cost trillions of dollars every year to take care of. Under whoever's paying for it. Excuse me.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm finishing an interview. Okay, I'll be right there. And they never mentioned that because somehow that's not ready to hand. We don't have, we don't have the staff of the lobbyists to produce studies and charts and things about the cause of what's going on now.
And
people dying now of diabetes. And, for example, people who live in food deserts, people of color, in this country, meaning they only have to go to fast food outlets is the only thing within a mile of their house. They don't have any vegetables for sale, no farmers markets there.
Yeah.
And they are costing trillions of dollars of Medicare and other hospital industry in amputation. It's because they get diabetes as teenagers, type 2 adult diabetes as teenagers by drinking their horrible Coca-Cola and Pepsi, the diabetes drinks, and then they amputate, they start as they get older, and they get some kind of, if not, any kind of insurance, because they just go to emergency room, they start amputating their toes. And work up the legs.
I know that's
horrendous.
We're looking a little
forward. And they can't do that now. All those surgeries are canceled now.
We're looking a little forward here.
But business as usual, including what should be good business, healing business, is not good. And it's not fair. And it is causing the destruction. And in a way, you could say, if people are whining about a terrible cost, you could say that, what is it? People who are dying of this virus are those mostly who have underlying conditions.
They're already sick.
Well, 50% of the American public has an underlying condition of cancer, heart disease, circulatory problems,
obesity.
Diabetes. Yeah, he calls it diabesity.
Yeah. This guy,
Mark Hyman, he's a family physician. He's not a specialist.
Yeah.
I love that about him.
Yeah.
And he's written 13 bestseller books about all the personal things you can do, you know, to try to your metabolism and your diet and all this kind of thing, because that's what he encounters so many patients like that. But what he's also done is he's gone and studied what's happening in Washington with the farm bill and the $700 billion subsidy we give to the food industry, not just $20 billion like the fossil fuel, hundreds of billions, maybe. Not all of the 700, like 625 billion out of the 700, goes directly and indirectly to the food industrial farms, not to family farms, not to people growing organic vegetables. None of it goes to them.
So
it goes to this poison food system.
And
even food stamps. You can buy Coca-Cola and Pepsi and this and that, and you can only buy a small amount of broccoli.
Imagine we get through this pandemic. How do you think it's going to change society?
Well, no, but it's giving people time to think. Out of the constant distraction and the constant momentum of the television brainwashing paid for by all these subsidies of taxpayers, we pay for that. Those companies don't pay for that lobbying and that. They get a subsidy from us to pay to poison us. We are doing that. And we don't even know how to make that clear. And he really did an awesome job of it. But he maybe is not quite as forceful as he could be. If Bernie had the lobbyists, if he had enough staff like any one of the lobbyists that he's had to deal with in Congress for a long time, which is why he's so frustrated, which is why I'm glad he's not the nominee probably, even though he has the more correct program. But he's just too frustrated. And too angry on the other way, I think loses it. Whereas Biden hopefully will keep one of the progressives in his vice presidency and his cabinet, at least a few of them. And then he might be a good manager of them all, I think.
And what
if he's not too sold out. And it's a danger if he doesn't keep some progressives in his cabinet and vice presidency. That is that he will be beaten by all the vote suppression, the voter suppressing Republicans.
Very, very possible.
If we
end up with neither Bernie nor Biden, if we end up with Trump 2, what does that spell for our future?
Well, no, I would recommend Elizabeth Warren rather than Bernie as the vice president.
Okay.
But then he could put Bernie as, although Bernie is really good in the Congress. You know, because we have to get the Senate back with this terrible McConnellist sabotage of all good things that goes on there, as Elizabeth is good there too, but she is a woman and she does have plans, and same as Bernie's, and she's rough, but she's maybe not quite as frustrated for as long as Bernie has been. He's been such a hero. Now, I totally don't think I don't admire him. I 100% do. I just don't think he's kind of got the persona for the presidency at this time.
But
he has the program for it, definitely, but not the persona.
But what if we...
I wanted Al Gore to run, actually. He's my favorite of all.
This time. What if we end up with a second Trump administration?
Oh, then I think it's going to be... It's the end. I mean... It already is the end of America, of democracy. Edgar Casey predicted it, and I'm afraid it already is the end. You know, when the Supreme Court majority is like a bunch of partisan vote suppressors, they're not a Supreme Court, so that's finished. And Trump is not a president. He just thinks he owns the government, and that means owns all the people. He's not of and for and by. It's of and for the Trumps. Jared Kushner said, well, wait a minute, those ventilators are ours. The federal ventilators, that's ours. Well, that's for us. Shows he thinks he owns it like a building. You know? So that's the end of the presidency. And McConnell has blocked. Luckily, we did get the House back, and some good has come from there. But but we've lost two and a half. We've lost one and a half of the houses of Congress because McConnell blocks anything good happening in the Senate, and completely. And the House, you know, temporarily is getting a few good things. So we have half of the House. So, but they can't do anything. They know won't get through the Senate. So they're kind of also blocked.
Yeah.
So we've lost. We don't have a democracy anymore. So the thing is making us think about, do we really want to live like that? So I think it will mean we will definitely throw those people out.
Well,
come November 3rd. I think so.
I think so.
I'm optimistic, but everyone has to really face the music and not just think it's just a game. It's not the usual game. It isn't.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask what the Dalai Lama is up to during this time. He's hiding.
What's that? I'm sorry.
I'm curious what the Dalai Lama is up to during these times.
Oh, he's just in retreat. You know, he's in isolation, India. I'm sure he's very anguished about the much worse explosion that's going to happen in India because of their huge crowding, the massive poverty, hundreds of millions. No way of handling that, normal way of handling that, except die off. You know?
Yeah, we haven't seen that. We haven't seen that quite yet, but we all kind of know it's coming, right?
He maybe his last public act internationally was to send $1 million to UNICEF, which he from his book royalties. Which he doesn't have that many million in his book royalties, but so he doesn't have enough to help all the poor people in India, unfortunately, but even all the poor Tibetans. But he did send that 1 million he just really wanted to earmarked for the starving kids in Yemen, which is embarrassing for us Americans since we're helping the Saudis bomb them. You know.
Yeah, it's really hard to
pick. He did that, but he's not making a lot of big pronouncements or anything. Just telling people to make some prayers and mantras, and think about, because think and try to cultivate compassion and feel the suffering of others, and always broaden out your own despair. If you get sick, or if your loved one gets sick, or even if someone dies, and broaden that out, and think of how many others are dying and getting sick, and through your pain, try to embrace their pain, you know.
Yep.
And this way, this is the way we'll come out of this, changing business as usual, if a lot of people do this.
Well, so,
and that he gives such a kind of advice, but he's not aggressively doing so.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it on that note, cultivating compassion.
Yes.
Great. Thank you,
Bob. But, you know, compassion, it's like the guy who founded Alcoholics Anonymous. One of his main concepts was what he called tough love, to not become codependent with addicts. And then with Tibetan Buddhism has a concept called fierce compassion, which means sometimes surgery. You know.
Well,
and you know, one last thing I want
yes,
to say,
sir.
In that light, one thing we could reflect on, because Greta is always so distressed about the mass extinctions of the animals. So the kind of poetic horror, but poetical, of this coming from a disease that normally afflicts bats and then sort of jumps into humans. It's kind of the sort of micro world, the micro universe is speaking back to us misguided humans who are extracting too much from nature and being too destructive in our own self-indulgence. So even though nobody's celebrating the marvelous corona, but the fact that we're given this chance to rethink what worse things we are creating for others, we should make a positive use of even this negative thing. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Bob.
Sorry to talk so long.
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Have a good rest of the day. Thank you, Bob.
Okay, thank you too.
Yeah,
okay,
see
bye.
You. Bye. Thanks to Bob Thurman for calling in from just outside Woodstock. Always a pleasure to hear what's on his mind. We'll be back with more of the Green Radio Hour with John Bauermaster here on WKNY Radio Kingston after these messages.
Kingston is facing unprecedented economic challenges as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic.
To help alleviate some of this financial stress, Radio Kingston, in solidarity with a group of local nonprofits, continues to raise money for our community fund, which is offering support to Kingstonians during this time of great disruption. Residents within the City of Kingston School District who are in need of financial assistance can receive one-time financial support through the Community Fund, which is administered by Family of Woodstock online via phone and drop boxes at Radio Kingston at 718 Broadway and Family of Woodstock at 39 John Street. This is a time to support our collective well-being and help each other navigate the road ahead together. We need your help in order to meet our community's needs. Please consider donating to help keep this resource flowing and be sure to apply if you need assistance. The Radio Kingston Community Fund, in partnership with Rise Up Kingston, O Positive, Good Work Institute, Hudson Valley Current, Hudson Valley Farm Hub, Kingston Midtown Rising, Harambe, Wild Earth, My Kingston Kids, Community Action, and Family of Woodstock. You can find the online application at radiokingston.org.
Hi, I'm Holly from O Positive. Are you interacting with the public during this pandemic as part of your job or role in the community? If you're feeling the stress, fear, and anxiety of being on the front lines, please reach out to Kingston Frontline, a new hotline for essential workers. 1-844-437-6856. Kingston Frontline, coordinated by Samadhi and O Positive, provides 24/7 free, confidential mental health services for everyone who is essential. Healthcare, custodial, delivery, mail, transportation, farm, grocery, municipal, utility, and domestic workers. It's also for the community organizers and volunteers who are keeping their neighbors fed and connecting them to vital services and housing. When you call Kingston Frontline, you'll speak with a trained responder who will connect you to appropriate resources, including licensed clinical therapists and support groups. It is not uncommon to feel unsure of your needs in a time of crisis or trauma. Responders can be there just to listen, no judgment or pressure. Call 1-844-437-6856 anytime. And for more information about Kingston Frontline, visit opositivefestival.org.
Jimmy Buff loves you.
I do. And in a time of COVID-19, we're adding some things to the program.
Hi, I'm Sean.
And I'm Micah.
We're breathing together
for 15 minutes, starting at 3:30.
I'm Rachel Loshak with Everyday Stories at 4:15.
I'm Mayor Steve Noble with updates from the City of Kingston, weekdays at 5 p.m.
Y soy Mariel Fiori con la actualización de noticias en español, weekday afternoons at 5:45.
That's Jimmy Buff Loves You, weekdays from 3 to 7 here at Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Welcome back to the Green Radio Hour here on WKNY, Radio Kingston, 1490 on your AM dial, 107.9 FM, streaming and archived always at radiokingston.org. This is the Green Radio Hour with John Bauermaster. I met Greg Trenish in 2007. He was in his early 20s, and he and his partner, Dea Schlossberg, had recently completed a 7,800-mile trek that took them the entire length of the Andes Mountains. They were hoping for an introduction to National Geographic, which I helped them with, only to watch them be nominated as Nat Geo's Adventurers of the Year in 2008. In 2011, Greg founded Adventurer Scientists as a way to connect the two different schools. Adventurers were going places that many scientists could not, but if properly trained, these same adventurers could gather incredibly important data while they're out in the wilderness. The Bozeman-based group, of which I am a longtime advisor, has been an incredible success, and Greg's accolades continue to mount. What do they do? Well, here's an example I'm reading from one of their reports. The 2018 pilot season of Adventure Scientist's Timber Tracking Project engaged 110 volunteers who succeeded in sampling from 1,023 big-leaf maples across California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. The resulting collections will fuel the research and development of multiple wood identification technologies to help battle against the illegal timber trade. That's just one example. Check out the other projects at adventurescientists.org. And here's Greg. I'm curious about his most recent accolade.
Yeah, so it's from the World Economic Forum. It was named a Young Global Leader, which it's pretty awesome. I mean, already, since the announcement came out in January, I've met with just dozens and dozens of people that are world caliber scientists and business people, It's really this incredible network of world leaders that we're now part of, and it just opens up so many opportunities for the organization. It's amazing.
And is it specifically younger people, or?
It's under 40. So under 40. Anybody, okay. Yeah, which is, you know, I'm not sure the thinking behind it other than they want to, the World Economic Forum, you know, what we hear of in Davos and all that is obviously a much broader network of people who are of all ages. And this is kind of their pipeline, I guess, to include people in that broader network.
Yeah. And who are some of your colleagues? I saw Pete Buttigieg on there.
Yeah, Pete Buttigieg is on there. And Rapinoe is on there, the soccer player. Yeah. And Juan Guaido, the opposition leader in Argentina. In Venezuela, not Argentina. Pretty incredible group of people. The young global leader class, so they're kind of lump us in. So it's a 5-year fellowship, essentially. And so I get 5 years of intensive training. I get to go to courses at, you know, Harvard and Oxford and Yale and all the greatest universities, if we ever get to go to those places.
Right. If they ever open up. And then you can do them online.
Yep, we can do them online, but certainly not the same experience.
No, that you kind of miss the social education part of it.
Yeah, I think those like cohorts or those networks are really such an incredible part of all the leadership training I've ever done and all the fellowships I've ever had. That's been one of the coolest parts, is just the peer-to-peer learning and the network of people that even in times like now with COVID, I can call them up and ask how they're handling things and what decisions they're being faced with. And it's just so comforting and also really informative to have those other perspectives from other people in the same position that I find myself in.
And this happened just a couple months ago or a few months ago?
So I was nominated last summer, and then in the fall, I was named a finalist and had a couple interviews, and then I got the announcement while they were in Davos this year in late January.
And how many persons do they choose?
I think there were about 20 this year from North America and about 115 around the world.
Oh, that's fantastic! When you meet people for the, you know, I'm privy to your success and the growth of your enterprise, but when you meet people for the first time, maybe in that cohort or others, how do you describe what you guys are up to today?
Yeah, so it's been really fun for me to just, I guess, hone in on the evolution of the organization. So, you know, I think when I started just coming to it from the adventure perspective, that was really what I knew and had been working as a field biologist, but really the adventure perspective is what drove me. And as time's gone on, and our kind of elevator pitch today, I guess, is that there are these incredible scientists all around the world, people that we are relying on to solve some of these major challenges, from deforestation and climate change to what we're seeing today with COVID and science. It's this really amazing time when people are seeing and recognizing science and scientists as our heroes. And that's what really we do at Adventure Scientists. It's finding those scientists that are at the cutting edges of their field and developing programs with them where the outdoor community can really contribute through their outdoor skill sets. And so that takes us all around the world, whether it's collecting genetic reference libraries for trees so that we can trace and track whether pieces of timber or logs were legally or illegally harvested, or it's working with medical schools around the world to isolate genes responsible for antibiotic resistance. We're looking for those cutting edge scientists and offering them the service of unlimited boots on the ground, because the outdoor community can get to anywhere and they really want to help.
And you still have no problem recruiting volunteers and helpers?
The outdoor community is so amazing. They have shown up in so many different ways for us and made it really easy to recruit. We have had really specialized projects where we've needed somebody with a particular skill set or in a particular part of the country that's challenging. But we have done this now for almost a decade, believe it or not. I can't believe that was almost 10 years ago. It's wild that time flies that quickly. So, but we've learned how to combat that. And so, you know, we can test really early whether we're going to fill the project, and then we can get it filled pretty quickly if we're slacking or slowing
down. And you're drawing on people around the world now.
We are, yeah. We you know, our projects ebb and flow, and so it really, because of this emphasis on the right scientists, and we're really looking for these places where data collection can unlock solutions to environmental or human health issues, we don't have as many projects as we once did. And so sometimes we're North America limited, and other times we've got global projects available. And so it kind of ebbs and flows, and we're constantly sourcing and developing new projects, and we're on the hunt for the right scientific partners who are people who are just forward thinking and thinking about solutions. And one of the greatest things we provide the scientific community is we can help remove the barriers that are in their way. You know, so often science has been limited by lack of funding. It's been limited by a lack of access, because on the scale we operate on, that hasn't been possible before. And we've opened up these opportunities for scientists to think bigger about the solutions they're working towards. And I just love that about what we do.
We have a really interesting project going on here in the farm, some of the farm fields near me in upstate New York. And it's organized by Woods Hole, which is over on the coast in Massachusetts. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a marine-based research facility. And it's kind of curious why they would set up testing in farm fields in New York. And it's because their argument is we're being impacted by climate change here on the coast, and we want to know, we're trying to figure out why and how. So they put monitoring devices in a variety of different kinds of farm fields. One was a you know, biodynamic, one was organic, one was a, you know, a traditional old school farm, and they're measuring the carbon coming out of the atmosphere, coming out of the ground via these different kinds of farming, and comparing it, and then using that to try and assess how that's impacting climate change. So lots of cool stuff going out there.
It is. Carbon sequestration in soils is this like incredible burgeoning field that we're learning so much more about different rotational practices. And there's this really cool project out of the Salk Institute where they're altering the genes of plants to increase suberin in the root systems, which, you know, makes root systems way bigger, but can increase crop sequestration of carbon by this exponential rate. It's awesome.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a long-term project trying to come up with a new definition, or a definition of today of what is exploration. You know, who are our explorers? Yeah. Because, you know, a lot of the traditional definitions, those have been fulfilled. You know, we've found new lands, we've found the precious jewels and minerals, etc. But there's still exploration going on there, and you guys are kind of partnering with a lot of the, and obviously scientists are a huge part of that, whether it's finding, you know, solutions to disease in the deep ocean or in space or on the ground. But that's kind of what you guys are up to, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, going to the far edges of the planet and looking for where nature can help us solve these challenges. Like, great example is we had some climbers climb Mount Everest, and we found fungi growing in the symbiotically with the moss that was up at 22,000 feet. And this was years ago, but fast forward today, and those fungi are now inoculating more than 3 million acres around the world. And the brilliant scientist we partner with on that, Rusty Rodriguez, has been able to get this into India, 300 small farms in India, and it's doubling crop yields without the need for synthetic fertilizers. I mean, nature has done such incredible things, and to go out and discover those, that's exploration to me these days, is how can we become more sustainable as a species? How can we have minimize our impact while our population continues to grow, because it is happening and will continue to happen until we hit, you know, upwards of 12 billion people. And so it's really important that increase in people doesn't devastate the resources that we have. And I think we're all really concerned that that's happening. But I'm betting on technology, and I'm betting on the scientists to solve these problems and to give us more sustainable ways of operating. And that's exploration. And that's what I think it has to be about. The days of, you know, you and I, John, have talked over the years of these ebbs and flows, right? It was Darwin and John Tyndall and these original explorers that were scientists and very much operating in this dual realm of exploration and science. And then sometime around the turn of the century, it started becoming much more about the biggest peaks and the furthest places. And then it's a time right now where that is, I think, drastically turning again. And we're seeing that because of the brilliant scientists that are getting additional platforms and ways that they can communicate their research. And that's one of the things Adventure Scientists is starting to think a lot more about, is how we can work with the outdoor industry to elevate scientists and help champion them as our heroes, instead of just the people who are going to go climb bigger peaks or go out into these remote areas without some type of scientific purpose or agenda.
Yeah,
and I'm really proud that
adventure for adventure's sake is over, I think.
It's got to be. We just don't have the I think there's an opportunity in what Adventure Scientist does is harness the skills that those people have, and it's really, really important that we do that, because they can be so helpful to solving these problems and so helpful to these scientists. And if they're just out there, it's a waste opportunity. It's just this lost talent that yeah.
I say adventure for adventure's sake is over, but I encourage everyone to go out and climb mountains and run rivers and test yourself physically, et cetera. But I've lost total interest in, you know, who's done the longest crossing of this or the biggest circumnavigation of that. I just that's no appeal anymore. But
exactly.
But I do, you know, we are operating this global experiment in a way that it's never been done before. People talk all the time about the planet and Mother Earth kind of regenerating itself after, you know, after cold snaps and heat waves and things, and the planet keeps bouncing back. But it's never had to do it with this grand experiment of humans on it. You know, 7.7 billion today, as you say, headed, you know, not so long into the future towards 11, 12 billion people. That's a huge experiment, and that's going to take a lot of effort by these scientists to keep up.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and the public has to adopt these things too. And they're, it's very difficult, I think, to, there's a lot of confusion about science today, and there's a lot of distrust, and that's really, really challenging. And that's not happening just here in the United States. That's happening in a lot of different places around the world. And I think that it's, you know, everything is heightened in times like right now with COVID too. It's we're seeing again the marginalization of certain groups of people, and their livelihoods are so important to think about as we go towards these solutions. If we can't find solutions that are easily adoptable, that affect in a positive way the bottom line of corporations, that give people options that are going to be beneficial, then it's going to fail. We have to find solutions that make it easy for people to say yes, because at the end of the day, most people on the planet do not have the luxury of choosing, you know, environment versus myself or environment versus livelihoods. And,
right.
And
or stay at home, you know.
Yeah.
Most of the world can't afford to stay at home.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Well, it will be interesting, you know, I can't even put those two words together, post COVID, because I'm not sure that I really believe it, but it will be interesting. It is interesting to watch scientists become kind of heroes, because as we know, at least in the political sphere for the last few years, and even before the last few years, there's been a big anti-science push at certain mm-hmm. high levels, and I think it's actually great that little Tony Fauci has become this superstar. Everyone hangs on his every word because people trust him, you know, and I think that may be one of the small silver linings of this, is that we return to a belief that science is important and scientists are important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if ever there was a time when it's clear that we have to invest in scientists with not just funding, but with what Adventure Scientist does, getting them access to more data, with celebrating them and giving them celebrity, because that's really, really important for their ability to then get funding and to their ability to do what it's going to take to solve a lot of these problems. And I'd encourage the scientific community to think and look about themselves as well. And it's not all scientists that are doing work that is solutions based, and it's not all scientists that are doing amazing work. There's an opportunity, if you've got that skill set, to think about how you can be working towards these solutions. And it takes investment in basic science, and it takes investment in applied science. And I think we are going to see that silver lining emerge from this. And I think that we're going to see some national heroes emerge from this. Whoever creates a vaccine,
yeah,
I hope that person becomes a household name.
And when you do manage to get your adventurers back into the field, what have you got some big projects coming up?
I'm so excited about the projects we're doing. So we've got a five-year partnership with the U.S. federal government in about 40 different states that is based on wild and scenic rivers. So we're going to have over 600 boaters, kayakers, rafters out on rivers collecting water quality data. Our water systems in this country are grossly undersurveyed. Over 40% of them have never really been surveyed for water quality. And so we're going to help the federal government get a handle on the state of these waterways. And it's really taking advantage of the five-year window between the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act and of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act.
Yeah, that Wild and Scenic Rivers Act has always been one of my favorite pieces of legislation ever.
Yeah, it's amazing to set aside these waterways for recreation, and because of their pristine natural beauty, it's awesome.
But are you going to look mostly at kind of creeks and streams and small rivers, or are you looking at big rivers? I mean, are you including the Mississippi and things like that?
We are, yeah. There's 228 rivers that, and it's really, it's rivers, but then there are stretches of rivers within. So you might have a section of each of those rivers, the bigger ones that are set aside as wild and scenic. And we'll be focusing on those wild and scenic river stretches. And that accounts for about 13,000 miles across the U.S., and including, you know, seven on the northern slope of the Brooks Range and in Alaska. And there's rivers that are on the Rio Grande. There's a section near Big Bend in Texas. And there's some beautiful, beautiful stretches that our volunteers will be going to. And we're using these really incredible cutting edge technologies. They're called FieldKit. And a friend of mine, another National Geographic explorer, has developed these. And they bring the cost of water quality monitors from tens of thousands of dollars down to the hundreds of dollars. And it's really making this science much more accessible. And we're really excited to be able to provide five different government agencies with the information they need to better manage these waterways.
Well, I'll send you a link to the film. We made a film a couple years ago working with Riverkeeper out here because they have a 10-year-long water quality sampling system that runs every year from May through October, totally dependent on volunteers. But anyway, we made a short film about it, and it's incredible what they're able to organize through this volunteer system.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. There's so many amazing small groups like Watershed, Water Keepers groups. They're out there fighting for their rivers. It's, you know, I think what Adventure Scientist brings is that we can do this on a very large scale because of the network we've built and these long-term monitoring efforts that just take local organizations to keep going. It's incredible. Citizen science and water quality monitoring go back to the, you know, 30, 40 years. This is really amazing.
You know, the Riverkeeper, original Riverkeeper started here on the Hudson 50-odd years ago. And yeah. It spawned more than 300 groups around the world: baykeepers, gulfkeepers, riverkeepers, et cetera. And and the Waterkeeper Alliance kind of overlooks all of those. So, if you send some of your volunteers out to the Hudson or any of the tributaries of the Hudson, let me know, and I'll connect them.
Yeah, that's awesome. We would love that. And federating and working with all these different smaller groups is certainly part of the plan for the Wild and Scenic River Project. And then we've got another where I mentioned this before, but the Timber Project, where we're taking these really important commercial tree species and we're mapping the genomes across the range of these species, and how those genomes shift from the northern part of the range to the central to the southern is allowing law enforcement to be able to trace and track the origins and thereby the legality of different wood shipments around the globe. So super excited about that project and helping to combat deforestation. The numbers are crazy. I had no idea when we got into this, but $157 billion a year are stolen out of forests around the world from poachers. And they're one in three products you buy on the international market come from an illegal source.
One out of three.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting when you scratch the surface a little bit, just how much bad stuff is going on out there. We made last year a big film feature documentary called Ghost Fleet, all about the fact that most of the men on commercial fishing boats, especially out of Southeast Asia, are slaves.
Yeah,
and yep. You know, the it wasn't so much a consumer appeal; it was a corporate appeal for big companies to trace their supply chains. Because, for example, most of the fish these guys catch goes into pet food. And in the United States, we have a $30 billion a year appetite for pet food, and Walmart sells $10 billion. So we screened the film in the Vatican, we screened the film at the UN, but most important screening, I think, was with the foundation folks from Walmart, who were well aware of the issue, but you know, needed a little nudge to remind them. So... No, it's great that you're out there. It's great you've had such success. I love this World Economic Forum thing. I mean, I guess you're on hold a bit. You don't have a plan to gather anytime soon.
No, we were due to gather at the end of August, and who knows if that will still happen. But, you know, so much is happening virtually. Like I'm thankful we're not, you know, this isn't 1918 with the Spanish flu, right? This is a time when we can still stay pretty connected.
Yeah, good point.
It's really amazing that a lot of work can continue. And I recognize that there are just millions of people who have been unable to continue their work, and that is absolutely heartbreaking. And yet a lot of the community can stay connected through the incredible tools we have at our disposal today. So it's not a good time ever to be in this situation, and it's better than I think they probably had it back then.
Yeah. Well, imagine if on top of this disease, imagine if the internet disappeared.
Oh, man.
How are you going to get Mayor Pete to volunteer on one of your projects?
I look forward to making that happen for sure. Megan Rapinoe is I'd love to see her. I'm probably saying her name wrong. I think it's Rapinoe.
Okay.
I want to get her out there. When she's doing training runs for soccer, we need to have her tracking Wolverines or something while she's doing it.
Exactly. Great. Well, great to catch up, Greg, always.
Always, John. Thanks so much. Really good to talk to you.
And we'll talk to you soon. Be well.
All right. Thanks.
Bye. That's it for the Green Radio Hour with John Bauermaster here on Radio Kingston. Thanks to my guests, Bob Thurman and Greg Trenish. Now it's time to get back outside. Thanks for listening.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the speaker or guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY, AM 1490, FM 107.9, Kingston, New York. From our studio in Midtown, this is Radio Kingston, WKNY, AM 1490, FM 107.9, Kingston, New York.
Come and hear a story every Sunday afternoon. Gather round the radio, we'll begin soon. Stories of the sunshine,